This program is made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Cotton Cloud Futons, a locally owned business featuring futons and mattresses, frames, covers, furnishings, and accessories which can be made with organic and recycled materials. Cotton Cloud is located at 701 Northeast Broadway in Portland. Information at 503-335-0758 or cottoncloudfutons.com.
Good morning. You're tuned to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. Welcome to the Tuesday Radio Zine. First, on Between the Covers, hear an extended interview with Daniel Dennett, author of Breaking the Spell. He'll talk about taking a rational response to religion. At 10, hear Taken Too Soon, a roll call of civilians and soldiers who have died in the war in Iraq. And at 11, on Democracy Now!, they feature a look at the Haditha massacre, an isolated incident or military cover-up. Other topics include the rise of violence in East Timor and the aftermath of the earthquake in Indonesia. Now let's go to Between the Covers.
Daniel Dennett is co-director of the Center for Cognitive Studies at Tufts University. His books include Brainstorm, Consciousness Explained, and Darwin's Dangerous Idea, which was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. His latest book is Breaking the Spell. Welcome to KABU.
I'm delighted to be with you.
Okay. Now, the spell you're referring to in the title in your latest book is the spell of religion.
Well, it's the spell of not studying religion. That is, the spell that I really want to break is the spell that says, don't look too closely. Keep religion behind a sort of veil of privacy, of sanctity. We're not going to study religion the way we study other natural phenomena. And I say that spell has to be broken right away. Religion is just too important for us to just trust the luck and not study it carefully.
But hasn't there always been kind of this almost detente between science and religion, where the scientists say, okay, we'll stay out of religion and you guys stay out of science, which of course has been breached by the intelligent design. But
well, I don't think that's actually a good way of looking at it. You're right that there has been a sort of detente. I'm not suggesting that science should try to horn in and do what religion is doing, but that it should study what religion is doing. And that should never have been part of the deal, as it were. Science can study anything, and it should certainly study religion, because religion has a profound impact on people's lives all over the world. Probably for most people on the planet, there's nothing more important to them than their religion. That's why we should study it, because everything we deal with in this century, if we don't understand the religious dimension, we're going to screw it up. We're not going to do the right thing.
How do you define a religion? I mean, I find that always interesting, because like the difference between like religion and cult is like the difference between a terrorist and a freedom fighter. It seems to depend on who's doing the defining.
There have been some cynical definitions, like a religion is a cult with an army. First of all, I do give a definition, but then I say when I give it, look, I'm going to look both sides of the line. I have to draw some lines, but I'm going to look both sides of the line in any case, so don't worry. I define a religion as a social system whose adherents profess belief in a supernatural agent or agents whose approval is to be sought. Now, that rules out black magic, because although they believe in supernatural things, this isn't, as it were, supposed to be good. And it rules out, actually, some forms of Buddhism, because they don't believe in anything, any supernatural agents.
Yeah.
So there's some things which maybe they used to be religions. After all, Halloween used to be a religious holiday. It isn't anymore. Things can stop becoming religions. Things can start being religions. And I draw the line, just for the sake of a definition, at whether you believe in a supernatural agent that you could, say, pray to, that you could expect to come to your aid. Now, many people, of course, if that's what religion is, they're not religious. They're members of a church, but their beliefs are so, sophisticated that they wouldn't actually qualify under the definition. That's fine. I look at that, too. I think it's very important, but it's not core religion for me.
Okay, so what kinds of things would you want to see studied about religion?
Everything. I want to understand how it has such a hold on people and why. Several hundred years ago, at the height of the Enlightenment, there were a lot of very well-informed and very intelligent people who thought that religion was going to evaporate. It was going to go extinct in a few years. No more reason for it. And, you know, science and reason had replaced religion. They were wrong. They were very wrong. What were they wrong about? What's the truth? Why is religion so powerful, so robust today? What does it provide for people? It provides something. And I think we really need to know. Before we think about what sort of revisions we might want to make to the world, we should see what we're dealing with. Religions have evolved over thousands of years. They're extremely well designed to do what they're doing. We should try to understand that design so we know how to improve it, how to change it.
So do you see religion as a positive force or a negative force?
I don't know. In some ways, it's obviously very positive. In other ways, it's obviously very negative. I think the fact that many religious people do not want to do the sums and see how it comes out, all things considered, is itself simply, I think that's unconscionable. I think we really have to look closely and objectively and see, does the good outweigh the harm? Many people are sure. Well, then they shouldn't mind proving it. Let's find out.
How would you measure something like the harm versus the good?
Well, some ways are pretty obvious. I mean, we have lots of perfectly objective scientific ways of looking at the effects of one thing or another, and we can study. I'll give you a few examples. Some of this work is already being done. If you look at the prison population in the United States, you see that it's just about perfectly mirrors the religious denomination population. That is, being religious doesn't keep you out of prison. That's an interesting fact, and I think it's pretty disturbing to a lot of religious people. You might think that the prisons would be full of atheists and agnostics. That doesn't seem to be so. And in fact, the divorce rate among evangelicals is much higher than it is among atheists, which says something interesting about family values, maybe.
Right, but that may have to do with other conditions other than religion.
It may indeed. That's why we have to do the research to find out. On the other hand, religion does seem to be good for your health, and there's been enough good, sound, careful, objective research to show that being an active member of religion really does seem to be good for your health. It doesn't matter which religion, but it does seem to be good for your health.
Well, that seems to be studying it from the effects on an individual.
Mm-hmm.
But then we also have to look at the effects on a society as a whole.
Absolutely.
For example, I mean, there's been so many wars in the name of religion, and there's a lot of, you know, people who carry around guilt and shame because of their religion.
You got
and
it.
How does that influence the culture? And then people do things like not use birth control because the Pope says it's sinful. How does that influence? How could you possibly measure that?
Well, I think you can measure that just fine. I think if we look, for instance, at the last thing you mentioned, if we look at the impact of the Roman Catholic Church's actions in Africa, they're really quite shocking, and I wish they were better known. I think the Catholic Church has a lot to answer for there. They've been, I was going to say, uncountable deaths, but in fact, we can count the deaths. We can count the deaths from HIV in Africa that can be put directly at the doorstep of the Catholic Church and at those American evangelical organizations that have also contributed to the abstinence only, and they've been discouraging the use of condoms in Africa. I think that is outrageous. I think that is really shameful behavior on the part of those religious groups, and I think it should be better known. But that's just one negative. I think you pointed to another one. I think the hypocrisy that we see in our country because of the presumption that you can't be moral without being religious. You can't be good without God.
Right.
What it means is that, for instance, how many of our congressmen, our senators and representatives, actually believe in God? They all say they do. But we all know that they know that if they didn't say that, they couldn't be elected. It's pretty clear that a lot of them are going, it's just lip service. Lip service is playing a huge role in the country's life. And I think it's just unfortunate that that's the case.
Now, a friend of mine who is very religious absolutely even refused to look at your book. And he said, you know, you have to look at people like Jimmy Carter and Martin Luther King Jr., who were inspired by their faith. And we really need religion.
Well, maybe he's right. Let's find out. I agree. Jimmy Carter and Martin Luther King Jr. are shining examples, and I am happy to give full attention to all the wonderful things that religion does. But I think religious people, if they want to be taken seriously, they think they occupy the moral high ground, then they shouldn't have any trouble saying, let's sit down and let's total it up. They have to acknowledge that there's a lot of harm that religions do. Every major religion has fanatical elements, violent elements. One of the great tragedies of religion today is that people, wonderful people, good people, they go out and they do lots of wonderful good deeds for their religion. And one of the sad effects of this is that this gives protective coloration to evil, violent people who act under the cloak of the religion and take advantage of the good reputation of the religion, and they're scoffing at the do-gooders, the ones that are actually doing good. They're hiding behind the veil of respectability that religion provides. That should be a moral quandary for just about everybody.
But then that kind of frames the question, is it religion that's the problem or fanaticism?
Well, that's a very good question. And it's not just religions that have fanatics, but religions do provide a safe haven or a safer haven for fanatics. And that's an important problem. I have a riddle in my book. I say, how's your religion like a swimming pool?
How is it?
Well, that's a strange question.
Yeah.
Well, the law says that your swimming pool is what's called an attractive nuisance. And that means it's so interesting and attractive that you are morally and legally obliged to take special steps to prevent innocent people from being brought to harm through your swimming pool. That's why you are obliged to fence it off. It's not good enough just to put up a no trespassing sign. You are morally required and legally required to police the thing and to prevent harm from coming, because it's anticipatable that kids, for instance, will come and they could come to grief in your swimming pool. In the same way, religions attract people with a violent streak, people who are just looking for a good excuse to be swashbucklers. It's not just religions that do this, but religions do this.
They tend to attract those kinds of people.
And I think that every religion has a moral obligation to be on guard against providing protective coloration to basically violent people who are using the religious doctrines as an excuse to be Rambo.
You know, in the book, you kind of go over some of why people are so attached to religion. Can you kind of give our listeners an idea of what you've looked at there?
Well, I look at religions from an evolutionary point of view and look at how they've evolved. And what I think you can see there is that, like music and like language, these are cultural phenomena that have evolved over thousands of years, and they've acquired features that nobody was really the author of. Nobody had to design them, but once they acquired those features, these features were very potent for preserving the very cultural items. And, for instance, religions have exploited, basically, our natural tendency to fall in love. Many people, basically they are in love with their religion. Not with the pastor, some people are in love with the pastor or the priest or the imam, but I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about people whose emotional set, whose emotional response to their religion is basically the response of romantic love. And of course, as everybody knows, love is blind, and love will not permit the loved object to be criticized and lashes out demonstrating by the fury of the reaction any slight of the beloved. This is a theme in every literature, that when you're in love, you're supposed to be willing to die defending the honor of your beloved. And so we see religions have all cottoned on to this. Every major religion has encouraged people to throw caution to the winds and just to make a great show of their love of their religion. I think that's a very dangerous thing.
Now, one of the things you talk about, too, is that the mysticism is really wrapped in incomprehensibility. You quote some religious texts and you call them incomprehensible. Actually, this is a quote from the book. People's discomfort with the sheer incoherence is so strong that there are always tantalizing elements of sense-making narrative punctuated with seriously perplexing nuggets of incomprehensibility. The anomalies give the host brain something to gnaw on. Now, I find quantum physics as incomprehensible as the doctrine of transubstantiation. What's the difference?
Yeah. Well, the difference is that quantum physics doesn't give you those little passages of complete sanity that you can keep your head around. Although it's interesting to see. It's a nice comparison. I'm glad you raised it, because, you know, people have heard of Schrödinger's cat. And they have a few stories they can tell, and they tell them and tell them and tell them. They like those stories. And then their eyes glaze over when it gets to the tough parts of the theory. It's not all that catchy, although there is a whole cottage industry of sort of pop quantum physics.
People trying to explain
quantum
this
and quantum that. So it does have some of the same flavors, and I think for the same reason, is that people love mystery. They love, oh, wow, that's impossible to explain. And so it's not surprising that religions have found it's sort of like the peacock's tail. The peacock's tail is extravagant. It's paradoxically extravagant. The peacock has the biggest darn tail it can possibly carry around, and it's showing off to the peahen and saying, look, I am so great, I can carry this preposterous tail around and I can still survive. This is costly advertising. Religions do the same thing. They say, ha, you think that's good, I can give you something even more mind-bogglingly incomprehensible and paradoxical. You want paradox, I'll give you something that'll really twist your head up. And it's not surprising that more rational, reasonable religions, which say, well, you know, it's all just metaphor. It's really just metaphor. They don't have the zing. They don't captivate the mind. I mean, when a religion says, no, 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 transubstantiation, this becomes the body of Christ. The wine becomes the blood of Christ. Man, that's hard to get your head around. That is something to...
That requires real faith.
That requires real faith, and that is it provides tension that increases one's allegiance when one thinks one's achieved it.
So how is this different from something like belief in quantum physics? I mean, I don't understand it completely, yet I'm willing to kind of give the scientists the benefit of the doubt that they know what they're talking about. Isn't religion kind of the same thing?
It's kind of the same thing, but with one huge difference. In the sciences, indeed, we get a division of labor, where we have the experts who understand the formulae, and then we have others who may be expert in some other area of science. They use the formulae, but they don't really understand them. They don't have to, because they can outsource that job to the experts that do understand. And they really do. And quantum physics is a classic case of this, because you've got breathtakingly accurate calculations from theory which are confirmed by experiments out to, you know, five decimal places. Now, there's nothing remotely like that in any religion. In fact, the experts themselves declare that the doctrines are incomprehensible. So that's a fundamental difference. If a religion had anything remotely like the predictive power of quantum physics, well, it wouldn't be religion.
Now, did you grow up in a religious family?
I grew up going to Sunday school and going to church. I know the hymns. I know I can, from memory, probably do a few psalms still and other Bible verses. So I know I know the traditions of Christianity, and I've sung in choirs and choruses all my life. So in a sense, yes. But it wasn't a deeply religious, it wasn't a devout family. It was just what we did in that town.
So what made you want to look at religion this way?
Well, after 9/11, I looked around and I thought, religion is growing in its importance in the world in ways that surprised me. I hadn't expected this. And I decided I should try to figure out what I thought was going to happen. And I realized I had no idea. And I looked around further, and I realized that nobody had any idea. And I thought, this is bizarre. We have people devoting their lives to understanding the energy crisis and global warming and fresh water and the monetary systems and all the other great global problems. And although there are people who are self-styled experts in religion, there's no unified effort to bring all of science to bear on religion to understand these phenomena from the ground up. And the reason that there isn't is that there's this sort of entente, as you say, that says, mustn't do that, mustn't do that. I say, no, we must do that. Let's have a Manhattan Project to study religion, because, my goodness, the stakes are so high now. A religion gone toxic could destroy the planet.
Yes, I look at some of the doctrines of the fundamentalists and their ideas about Armageddon, and I look at our president is actually seems to be an adherent to these, and I kind of have always wanted someone to ask him, well, what is your opinion of the rapture? Because it almost seems like a lot of the policies seem to be geared towards bringing about more violence than it's settling. But here's the problem. If we sat down and analyzed all of this information and came up with, you know, there is such a thing as a toxic religion, and as a society, we need to do something to keep that in check. How does that square with the freedoms of religion and even just any sort of kind of social freedoms that we have?
I think that's a very good question. I have partial answers, and the rest will have to depend on doing some of this research. But I do have several very concrete suggestions. First of all, let me say something about education. I think we need to have more education about religion in the schools. I think we should have a national curriculum, facts about all the world's religions, and it should be for public school kids, for private school kids, for homeschoolers, for everybody, from primary schools through high schools. Just facts, no proselytizing, no value judgments. As long as children learn this, then their parents, I say, can teach them whatever they want. Absolute freedom of religion. They can teach their kids any doctrines they like. They can tell their kids, this is the truth, and we're the only ones that have the truth. But they've also got to tell their kids, we are in a minority. Here's what other people think. And here's what the Hindus think. Here's what the Muslims think. And they simply have to inform their children of those facts.
Man, I could see that opening up a huge can of worms.
Well, why?
Even just the what religions get included in this curriculum would be something that would be a big controversy. Do you include the Wiccans?
Well, indeed. I think that it would require a national political conversation. I expect there would be great proposals and counterproposals and negotiations. To a first approximation, I would say each religious group gets to propose what they would like to have said about them, but then a multi-religious, pluralistic group would sit and look at this and say, well, okay, you can say this, this, and this, but there's also these other facts, and those are true. They're in the history books, and these facts are you may not like these facts about your religion, but you have to admit they're true, and we would like to include them too. And we would have to achieve some agreement on this. And as you say, what about the Wiccans? What about Santeria? What about there's thousands of religions, and obviously the small sects should be mentioned. I think everybody should know what some of these small sects are like and what they're doing, what they're saying. But the main thing I want to stress is The only reason that I can see for opposing this is that people want to keep their children in ignorance. Now, they'll say, we want to keep our children innocent as long as possible. No, I think the word is ignorant. These are just facts, and I don't think parents have the right to enforce ignorance on their children.
Yeah, that does bring up the issue of parental responsibility. I mean, we've already had some cases where, like the Christian Scientists who don't want to have their children treated for treatable diseases, I could see the same sorts of arguments being used for religion on this. It's like they could say, well, as part of our religion, we believe you shouldn't even look at the other religions. And then doesn't that pit logic against parental rights?
Well, look, we've already done this. And indeed, there are going to be lots of tough cases in the middle. But we don't let a religion now say, well, we want to teach our children that human sacrifice is a really good thing. Oh, no, 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 no. Doesn't make any difference how intense your religion is. Human sacrifice is completely out. Animal sacrifice, well, you know, Santeria, that's right on the borderline. Some people think freedom of religion, they should be free to sacrifice chickens, for instance. But they better not sacrifice dogs. These are difficult political decisions we've got to face. But we wouldn't allow any religion to say, we refuse to let our children learn to read. We absolutely wouldn't permit it. That would be child abuse. That's why we already have reading, writing, arithmetic, and American history. Even if you're homeschooled, you have to do that. I'm just saying, that's already established. Everybody agrees about that. And yes, in those cases, we simply will not honor a religion that says we think we should keep our children ignorant.
Well, we've already got that sort of debate going with the evolution versus the intelligent design sort of argument. Do you think that debate is really about the existence of God as opposed to what they're saying it's about?
It's hard to know what the intelligent design people are really doing, because they've been so disingenuous, as Judge Jones pointed out in his magnificent court decision in the Dover, Pennsylvania case. They lied and lied and lied. That's his word on the stand. They lied and lied and lied. The idea of, as it were, lying for Christ, lying for God, it has a long tradition, and the judge called it correctly in that case. But now let's look at the issue here. My view is, if you want to teach your kids the intelligent design story in school, I mean in your church or at home, fine. But it has no business being in a biology curriculum, because it just ain't science and it just ain't so. And if you want to teach about it in current affairs, that's fine, because it's certainly a controversy, but it's not science. It's interesting that the Discovery Institute, which is the sort of organization that has led the charge for intelligent design, has backed off now. They say they agree that intelligent design should not be taught in biology classes. And the reason they agree is very simple. They don't have any science to show. When people began to say, well, what would you actually teach? They, well, no, no, we don't. We just want to teach that there's a controversy.
Okay. So
they can teach that in current affairs, not in the science class, because there isn't any controversy in science. There really isn't.
You would never know that by the way it is reported and by the number of polls that...
It is fascinating to see what a clever job the intelligent design community has done in creating a lot of smoke and a lot of mirrors. The idea that there's a controversy in the sciences is very widespread, and it's just not true. And notice it's the same tactic that was done on global warming. Is there controversy over global warming? No, not in the scientific community. There isn't. There really isn't. Oh, there's a few fringe scientists, but it's just not a controversy. It's only, it's interesting. Somebody recently did a study, and they looked at, I think it was something like 800 or 900 scientific articles. All, you know, the 800 or 900 most recent scientific articles having anything to do with global climate, and found that not a single one of those articles was were skeptical about the reality of human-caused global warming. Then they looked at magazine articles and newspaper articles on the same topic, and they found about 50-50.
Wow. But that says a lot about the power of the very wealthy, very influential oil companies and a whole industry that's
Absolutely.
Built on this. Don't you think we run into the same sorts of things with the religion? I mean, religion is a big industry.
It's a very big industry.
Got a lot of money and
tremendous resources. It's very wealthy. It is a major economic power in the country. They've got a lot of money to spend, and I think that fact is something that people should know too.
So, has any politicians looked at your proposal to kind of put together this national curriculum on religion? And is this?
No, we're talking grassroots at this point. I haven't been dealing directly with politicians on it. I've mentioned it to a few, but I haven't tried to extract any commitments from anybody yet. It seems to me that it's practically a no-brainer. It's simply consistent with our principles of our informed democracy. I mean, informed consent, that is the principle we live by. The idea that you should misinform or keep ignorant our citizens is just, it goes against everything in the American way. And notice it's completely free otherwise. It says you can teach your children whatever you want. There's no forbidden doctrines. Teach them whatever you want, as long as you also teach them this stuff. These are just facts.
Have you had any kind of reaction from religious communities about your book?
From many religious individuals, and it's been all over the map. I've had some wonderful reactions from ministers and from rabbis, from priests who are very much in favor. They appreciate the book. They respond reasonably to it. And then I've had people that just lose it and have lashed out at me in ways that I think in retrospect they'll be ashamed when they look back and realize that they could not confront these issues reasonably. It's interesting. A lot of people in academia that I know, my colleagues, and of course the academy is sort of famously liberal and sort of anti-religion, and a lot of these people, they said, Dan, you're on a fool's errand. You will never get religious people to read this book. They are simply unable. They are simply incapable of responding rationally on the topic of religion. And I said, I don't believe that. I'm sure there's many that are incapable, but I think, in fact, that that's a very patronizing and demeaning view to take of religious people. I think they're serious, I think they're intelligent, and I think if you appeal to them directly to their reason and make them see that these are important issues, that they can get on board, and they may want to disagree vigorously with some proposals or some analyses of mine, fine, bring it on. But I think that they can do this in the spirit of this is rational inquiry. And indeed, some can. But then there are those who just can't. And I expected them, and it's sort of ugly to watch it happen. It's not fun. But it does sort of prove my point that a lot of religious people are a lot less reasonable than you might have supposed. And when you get a little close to the bone, they reveal a certain disability. They are simply unable to participate in a reasonable discussion of these issues.
But it's not just any issue. You're talking about an issue that's at the very core of some people's identities, right, and their whole relation to the universe.
Exactly. And if they are so enslaved by those ideas that they cannot take a deep breath and consider calmly the conditions that surround that, if they're not able to assess their own position in the world, if they have to just close their eyes and lash out in a sort of blind, screaming way, we should know that. It's a scary fact about them. And we should recognize that they may seem to be in control and to be, as it were, good moral citizens, but in certain regards, they're disabled. They're disabled for adult moral considerations. But I think that's a minority.
That kind of brings up an interesting point, because it's like already we have sort of an informal consensus about what is a toxic belief and what's not a toxic belief. The examples you brought up, like, cannibalism, we'd say, no, absolutely, no matter how strong your belief system, we will not allow this in any way, even under the guise of religion. So what's left is the beliefs that are kind of in that gray area. And
let's sit down and let's look at the area. Let's look at what's in at the bright area, the area that, where there isn't really disagreement, where it doesn't matter whether you're a Muslim or a Christian or a Hindu or an atheist, you agree that this is what human decency requires. There's actually quite a shared area. Let's start with that. And then let's bravely, gently, let's explore out around the edges and see what the gray areas look like. Now, when we do that, that's a political discussion, and it's one that I welcome. And it's the way religion actually, if you look, all religions have evolved tremendously over the last few thousand years. The Christianity of today is very different. I mean, Christianity is 2,500 different things anyway, but they're all quite different from the original Christianity in what they, in what the prohibitions are, what's allowed, what the aspirations are, the interpretation of the text. This has all evolved over time, and it's going to evolve a lot in the future. The question is it going to evolve through bloodshed or through reason? And I'm saying we can sit down and talk these issues through. Now, many people say, no, we can't. These are sacred values, and what a sacred value is one where it's evil even to think about it. Thou shalt not think about this. This, don't even think about it. Well, I'm saying recognize that that is itself a curious feature. The idea that there should be values that you feel guilty even thinking about. Philip Tetlock and his colleagues have done some fascinating experiments with that. And I want to challenge that presumption.
It seems like in the past 30 years, there has been a rise of not just religion, but fanatical religion. Have you studied this at all? Is that...
That's one of the things that I'm urging much more study. I've studied it informally, and I've got some good questions, and I think some people I talk about in my book, one of the main points is to draw attention to the work that is being done and explain what the good work is and why, and to show that we actually can get a grip on these questions. I'll give you one. This is not proven. This is somewhat of a shoot from the hip hypothesis about what's happening, but I think it has some backing. Think about, compare it with what we've also seen, and this is not controversial, with transportation, airplanes, ships, etc., all over the world. All of the natural barriers that kept species isolated from each other have evaporated. Now we have invasive species everywhere, and some of them are wonderful, and some of them are really causing terrible problems because the natural barriers to the spread of species into new areas have been eliminated. Everybody knows the problems that are caused by these invasive alien species. But that's nothing compared to what's happened in the world of culture with the spread of cell phones and the web and mass communication, cable television and the like, radio, transistor radio is very important in this. What's happened is this information explosion all over the globe, so that human culture is spreading just the way the biosphere is spreading, and religions that have depended on the isolation of the people in these different cultures, they can no longer secure that isolation. And so the leaders and the devout within the religions are casting about somewhat desperately for responses to this, to their lights, terrible invasion of alien ideas. That's what we're seeing, I think. It's the response of all religions to what is, in many ways, a very alarming trend, the idea that all of these alien ideas are flooding in and confusing and upsetting the brethren.
Do you think it may be partially a response to the rate of technological change and just kind of the overwhelming, I mean, we've seen so much change in the way people live their day-to-day lives in the past 100-150 years. And do you think this kind of holding on to what seems to be a tradition or an absolute idea is a reaction to that constant change?
I think that's a very plausible hypothesis. It's what I've come to realize in the last few years as I've been working on this book and looking at the research is there's a lot of very plausible hypotheses of these sort of this sort. It's almost certainly something to them. But rather than just settle for them and say, oh, well, that's what it is, I understand it, we should actually submit them all to proper testing, because some of these very plausible hypotheses may turn out to be false. And just because they're plausible doesn't mean they're true. Just because that's what everybody says doesn't mean they're true. We've really got to grit our teeth and do the research that will tell us which of the many plausible ideas about the function of religion, the origins of religion, which of them actually pan out. Until we get those answers, we're flying blind.
Okay. Well, I've been speaking with Daniel Dennett. His latest book is Breaking the Spell. And thank you very much for coming in and talking with us.
Marianne, thanks very much. I enjoyed talking with you.
KBOO is proud to co-sponsor the Spiral Rhythms 2006. This year's Spiral Rhythms will feature 4 days of music and magic from Mother Earth. Mark your calendars for June 1st through the 4th and participate in pagan rituals, campfire jams, drum circles, and workshops on music, magic, and the environment. This year's Spiral Rhythms Festival will be held in Klickitat, Washington. Music performed by Jim Page, Danny Dollinger, Peg Millett, Betsy Holt, and many more. That's Thursday, June 1st through Sunday, June 4th. Get more info at spiralrhythms.org.
Hi, I'm Stephanie Potter with a new monthly show on KBOO Radio, The Recovery Zone, featuring groups and individuals who recognize the dis-ease of the world today. They're working to bring changes to our present way of doing things. My guest this Thursday will be spiritual ecologist Morgan Grant, who through lecture and song teaches about earth consciousness and what he calls the Silvapalatin.
Silva means of the forest or of nature. Palatin means citizen of. So he's like the citizen of the city-state, of nature, or the forest. And because I worked in the forest pretty extensively, I can see this very much like a forest being a great city. So in many ways, the Silvapalatin is someone who is cultivated in this dialogue with nature. And there's a more full-spectrum human in the Silvapalatin.
To hear more, tune in on Thursday at 10 a.m. to the Recovery Zone on KBOO Radio.
You're listening to KBOO Community Radio, 90.7 FM. It's 9:43. Still to come on the radio zine at 10, hear Taken Too Soon, a roll call of civilians and soldiers who have died in the war in Iraq. And at 11, Democracy Now! Features a look at the Haditha massacre, isolated incident, or military cover-up. Other topics include the rise of violence in East Timor and the aftermath of the earthquake in Indonesia. Up next, until 10, we'll hear a couple of reports from the series Between the Lines.